From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
Hervé Thys, a pioneer in the field of molecular gastronomy, has been using research in the chemistry, physics, and biology of food to challenge many traditional ideas about cooking and eating. His book, Molecular Gastronomy, Exploring the Science of Flavor, has recently been published in an English translation by Columbia University Press, and I'm pleased that it has brought Hervé Thys to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
So how does molecular gastronomy differ from what we've been calling food science for all these years?
Well, the science of food developed for a very long time. For example, the famous chemist Lavoisier, in the father of modern chemistry, even investigated stock preparation.
Which remains pretty much the same as it always has since the Middle Ages, hasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. More or less, because, in the Middle Ages, in the very old culinary books, they say that you should always put the meat into boiling water. And nowadays, they say that you should put it into cold water. So what? And this is part of my job, to investigate all these old wives' tales. And I've since 1980 now, have more than 25,000 such old wives' tales that I have to check, and we have to check to know the truth. Are they true? Are they wrong? Nobody knows.
You're a staff chemist with the Institut National de la Recherche Agronomique.
Well, it's equivalent of the agronomical research.
So is molecular gastronomy a typical area of interest at the Institute?
Well, yes, because they pay me. No, I have two labs in this institute. Well, more and more students, more and people interested in this way we consider food. I'm not interested in food, the detailed composition of a carrot, for example. I'm interested in cooking. Cooking and more. For example, when you pour some wine on your table, sometimes it is said that you should add some salt on it. Is it true that you have less stain? Well, let's make the experiment. Let's investigate the chemistry of the thing.
And so they say salt and sparkling water.
Yeah, they say so.
I never understood the sparkling water.
No, I never understood the salt either.
Well, let's get to just how we react to food. Not everyone agrees on what tastes good. So how much of that is culturally determined, and how much is a matter of our body chemistry?
This is a really good question. Theodosius Dobzhansky, the famous biologist, said everything that is concerning living things should be interpreted in terms of bioecological evolution. Our palate has been determined by millions of years of evolution. It's very interesting to compare the way apes eat and we eat. For example, it has been discovered recently by friends of mine, Claude Marcel Ladig, that the apes have cultural habits on eating. Depending on the way, the place in the forest we are living, they can either wash their potatoes or not. This is very interesting. And we should remember that we are apes.
Well, does the brain learn to love certain flavors? Some people will remember their first taste of coffee or wine or whiskey, and often it resulted in them spitting it out because they found it unpleasant at first. Later, they felt they couldn't live without it.
Yeah, the question of the innate and what we acquire when you grow up is very
interesting. Kids will ask, why do adults eat this stuff? Why do they like this stuff?
When you take newborns, human newborns and apes, they have the same reaction when you present to them some sweetness or bitterness and so on. For the primates, they ate bitterness because it's associated with toxic products in the forest. But sweetness is associated with energy, and this is why children like sweet. The question is, how is it that later they become pleased with some bitterness. And my interpretation has something to do with we are a gregarious species, which means that we love to be together. If someone, a child, comes to in a group of beer drinkers, for example, is repelled by the taste of beer, but the gregarious reward is more than the sensorial punishment. And this is the way we begin in, for example, Munster cheese. Wow, Munster cheese from Alsace. The smell is awful, but the taste, wow, wonderful.
So we have to get past it. It's the reason I started smoking many years ago. Luckily, I was
able
to quit.
Same effect.
It was a social thing.
Yeah, same effect. And indeed, it has been studied by scientists, and it is called the beer and tobacco effect.
Now, have we done MRIs and PET scans of people eating foods that they like, foods that they don't like? What do we learn from those?
Well, it's just the beginning, of course, because these kind of techniques are quite new.
And PET scans are so expensive.
Well, less now than it was. But a friend of mine, Annick Forion, is studying the taste, not flavor, only taste. And she's able now to recognize some specific area in brain when you can recognize the sweetness. Mind the fact that there are no four tastes. This is a wrong theory. For example, if you taste glucose, which is one sugar, and sucrose, which is ordinary sugar, the sweet taste is different. If you compare now the acidity of tartaric acid, you know, the crystal that you have sometimes in the wine bottle, the white wine, it's tartaric acid. It's acid, but it's not the same acidity than vinegar. So there are many sweetness, there are many acidities, and there are many bitterness. For example, if you like Schweppes, you have some bitterness. You cannot fight the bitterness with sugar. You feel both. But if you burn some onions, the onions become bitter, and you can fight the bitterness with sugar, which means that there are many, many interesting phenomena in the kitchen daily.
Well, in some cultures, like the Chinese, you want to have that sweet and sour together. They like the idea of they want to have crunch and soft. They want to have those contrasts as a basic way of approaching food.
Yeah, but you know, if we discuss taste, tastes are recognized by taste buds in your palate and on your tongue. So tastes are quite different from astringency, for example, or other sensations. Now, in Japan, people have a theory of a fifth taste called umami. Umami is a taste of MSG, monosodium glutamate. And I just come back from Japan and I realize that they are wrong in proposing the umami. And I was wrong for 10 years of saying there are no four tastes, there are probably five. Indeed, there is an infinite number of tastes, probably. But the umami, depending, for example, Parmesan cheese has certain amino acids, and they have certain taste. The glutamate, which is more or less extracted from what they call kombu. Kombu is a seaweed. This is another taste from another amino acid. And if you taste the particular amino acids, they are wonderful tastes, which are all different. And then there is no umami. There are many amino acid tastes. And this is very important for chefs because they can play with the amino acids now.
And create very subtle differences as a result. My guest is Hervé Thys. His book, Molecular Gastronomy, Exploring the Science of Flavor, is published by Columbia University Press. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is the tongue the only taste perceptor in the body?
No. No. This area is not very well known. It's clear that we have some taste buds all in the mouth, but the receptors, as we say, are not well known. For example, very recently, there have been discovered new receptors for fat. Well, apparently, fat has no taste, but they are recognized. This is a very important discovery, very recent.
And food cooked with fat often tastes better to us than food cooked without fat, even though we don't taste it.
Yeah, but there are many, many reasons for that. First of all, if you put some butter in your fridge, near garlic, for example, your butter has a flavor of garlic because the odorant molecules are generally not soluble into water, but soluble into fat. So if you add fat, except when it is pure fat with nothing in it. But if you are fat, it's very frequent that you bring some odorant molecule along. This is exactly why in the chemistry lab you should not eat, because the organic solvents are very toxic and they are soluble into fat. So if you eat something with fat, whoop, it goes into the fat and you die. Never eat in a lab. Never eat in a lab.
Sometime in the recent past, we had somebody here who did a little test with us, put nose clips on, and then we had different jelly beans, or different beans, one with a very strong coffee flavor, one with a very strong citrus flavor, I can't remember what else, and could not taste them at all until we took the nose clips off. So obviously the nose is a key to our sense of taste.
Yes and no, because if you burn your mouth with a hot potato, you don't feel nothing. You feel nothing, which means that the taste is as important as the odor, contrary to what was published. You know, there were a lot of mistakes about flavor. For example, there is a map of the tongue, and they tell you that at the tip of the tongue, you can recognize sweetness. Well, in my seminar, I have a monthly seminar in Paris, but I'm happy to tell you that I just created a New York seminar on molecular gastronomy yesterday. But in my seminar, we had the experiment of, well, we are having 200 people, just they had to dip the tip of their tongue into a solution of water plus sugar, and 40% could not recognize the sweetness, which means that this map is wrong. Many people say what they feel, not the truth. And, wow, we have to make experiments, cautious experiments, very long, very patient to know the truth.
But also that experiment would suggest that it's different for different people.
Yeah.
Because 60% did taste the sweetness. So
More or less, because it's more difficult than that.
Is that why some people like food more than others? Because they perhaps have more sensitive receptors?
Oh, I would not say more sensitive receptor, because there is a whole chain between the receptor and your brain. There are many, many events, but we are all different. And this is the question. But the same for the color vision. You and me, we do not recognize, we not perceive the same color, but we are able to say this is blue or this is red. And when you smell something, you can say this is tobacco or this is lilac and so on. We have different receptors. And this is why when we test wine, one never should say, well, there is an almond taste. Perhaps you feel the almond taste and the other will not feel it. So it's different for everybody.
You've collaborated for years with the chef Pierre Gagnaire. What do you both hope to get out of that collaboration?
Well, as a scientist, I should produce only knowledge. Science should produce only knowledge. It's not technology. But because Pierre is a friend, the enterprise is wonderful. Every month, I have to give him an invention. I make a text of it. He published the text on Insight, on Internet, and as a reward, a friendly reward, he has to invent between one and four dishes based on the invention to show the way. And this is given to everybody in the world through Internet. So it's a very exciting enterprise. For example, the last one was the invention of artificial fruits. Very easy. From a scientific point of view, it is nothing. Technologically, it's funny, and artistically, it can be wonderful when the artist is great.
So he's making artificial fruits?
On vegetables, on meats, and so on. Artificial, I hear you. When I say artificial, you say, wow, artificial, wow, synthetic things, awful chemistry. No. Remember the etymology of the word. Artificial means art. And art is much above nature, because nature will kill you. The tsunami kills you. So art is the main point in the humankind.
Eat the wrong mushroom and you're dead.
Yeah.
Some of the hottest chefs in Europe have been using new techniques, cooking with liquid nitrogen, and then there's one who's created combinations with cotton candy and foie gras, things of that sort. Some of it sounds kind of silly, but do you see the future of cooking coming out of this kind of experimentation?
Well, you know, what is called molecular cooking, which is the application of molecular gastronomy. Well, they are chefs with three stars, so they are very successful. At Ferran Adrià, El Bulli, all over the world, people want to go there. On Eston Blumenthal, you mentioned more or less Eston Blumenthal in the UK, or Wiley Dufresne in New York, and some people like that. Everybody wants to go there. Well, they are pioneers. They are the first. And I think that the new generation of chefs will take the best of the old and of the new. For example, Daniel Boulou in New York is able to produce something very subtle, very delicate, very, wow, many associations. There is no smoke, no explosion, but it is wonderful. Wiley Dufresne on the reverse, he's very good, he's having a good technique. Imagine the next generation when someone will take the best of the two. Wow, it will be much better.
You have a cooking show in France. Are cooking shows as popular in France as they are here?
Yes.
But I assume that yours really is about the science of cooking.
Sure.
I'm not a cook. Fine dining seems to be a natural part of life in France. There's always been talk about the French food culture. How do you think that happens? Are the kitchen skills still passed on from one generation to another, or are things changing?
Well, it's changing, but I'm trying to change again. For example, I'm promoting the introduction of culinary curriculum in schools. For example, in France now, at school, people aged 6 years old are producing 1 cubic meter of whipped egg white with one egg. Okay?
I'm not sure I understood that.
You take one egg, you whip, and children 6 years old can produce at school in France 1 cubic meter, which means 1 meter by 1 meter, huge volume. And this is a wonderful educational enterprise. Imagine these people when they are grown up. Ha! Huh. Wonderful. And this is part of culture. You know, science is culture. Art is culture. There is no reason to divide. We should merge them.
Although in food, there has been a lot of resistance to scientific change. You know, a chef will tell you must first braise the meat before you do this. It seals in the flavors. There are all of these old ideas that sometimes turn out to be true, but often turn out not to be true.
Well, having more than 25,000 such things, I can make some statistics. And I would say that I call them precisions, culinary precisions, because they are on top of the definition of the dish. Some of them seem true and they are true. Some of them seem true and they are wrong. And you have all categories. And one never knows, because as cooking was an empirical development, you added and added and added some knowledge, more or less. And finally, we are there. And we are living in the house of the grandfather, and it's time to put the electricity in. So we have to change. Anyway, you have to change.
My guest is Hervé Thys, T-H-I-S, a physical chemist on the staff of the Institut National de la Recherche Agronomique in Paris. He's the author of several books about food and cooking and a monthly contributor to Pour la Science, the French language edition of Scientific American. His latest book, Molecular Gastronomy, Exploring the Science of Flavor, which is published by Columbia University Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Hervé Thys, H-E-R-V-E, accent aigu.
the equivalent of Harvey in English, let's say.
Harvey.
Yeah.
T-H-I-S, Thys, and his latest book, Molecular Gastronomy, Exploring the Science of Flavor, which is published by Columbia University Press. We've been hearing more and more from chefs about the importance of using local ingredients just as they come out of the ground. How important is the role of the garden to your vision of cooking and food?
I mean, the products. I'm fearing the idea of having products because, if cooking were only to choose the products and to grill, watch, and it's finished, it's not cooking. It's choosing products. And the culinary activity is really something. You know, let's take the example of music. You have some notes. The notes are nothing. And then you build some music. I prefer the idea of cooking this way. So you have products. That's true. But what you have to do is to make something out of them. And then you need culinary skills.
But do great taste depend on great ingredients? Or can the chemist, the food scientist, make adjustments that will turn something mediocre into something fabulous.
You know, Pierre Gagnaire, you mentioned Pierre Gagnaire, my friend recently. He had the visit of journalists at the restaurant, and just for the fun, he decided to go to the supermarket to buy some very, very cheap meat and to make a great art piece. Just like you take Picasso the painter, he could have just a pencil and make something great. That's my idea. Of course, if you pay a lot for truffles, for lobster, for foie gras and so on, well, okay, it would be good. But you know, in painting, this is a mistake. When you have some golden things everywhere, it's not art. It's just gold.
But this goes against everything the French have been saying for years, that terroir, the microclimate that the food is created in, is a key factor.
For example, if you want to make a very good Munster cheese, you cannot make it in Paris. You have to go in Alsace. There is a national program in France to know the truth about terroir. Is it true for cheese? Is it true for ham? Is it true for sausages? Is it true for beer? Is it true for wine? The answer is yes. For certain products, this is very important. And for others, it's just cultural habits that produce some good food. Of course, today I had a pizza in New York. The cheese had no taste. It was not a good cheese. Well, if the painter has a very good pencil, the art piece will be easier to make.
But you do say that you've seen that if cows graze on one side of a hill, the cheese is going to taste different, probably the milk as well, than from the cows on the other side of the hill.
It's very interesting. But we have to discover these things, because up to now, there was a feeling about terroir. You know, when you go into Burgundy wineyards, it is obvious. The same guy doing the same wine, the same way, downhill and uphill, and there is a tremendous difference. So the terroir is very important for some products. As a scientist, I want to know where the terroir is important and where it is not.
Well, let's say for a carrot or...
For carrot, it's important. We have a seminar. We had a full seminar on cooking cauliflowers. Wow. We had experiment on it. It was so different depending on the field where the cauliflower were grown. Wow.
Doesn't that work?
Sorry?
Where isn't terroir important? Is it for fruit? Would an orange taste different in different vineyards?
Probably. For orange, I don't know, because we don't grow orange in France, and I'm not used with that.
Granny Smith apple, which you do grow?
Probably. But, the science of it has not been done now for the granny apple. It has been done for cauliflower. It has been done for sausages and
so on. Well, there's another project.
Next book, yeah.
Is it... Well, since we're talking about wine, what about the combinations of food and wine? There are some people who really insist that you must be very scientific about it. Are there certain foods and wines that don't marry?
Yes. I had a radio show, a daily radio show last year in France, just to give some ideas about that. There is a very funny experiment. You take a very astringent wine, for example, from Bordeaux. You take one sip. And you swallow it, and then you spit it in your glass. You will see that there are deposits. This is because in your mouth you have some proteins in your saliva, and the tannins of the wine is reacting chemically with the proteins, and this makes the deposits. The same experiment, you can do it with children at home. You make a very strong tea, clear tea, and you add some gelatin sheets, which are proteins, and immediately it's turbid. Because there is a precipitation. This is the same effect, which means that if you want to drink some astringent wine, either you get the dry sensation in your mouth, or you eat food that is bringing protein so that you cannot have the sensation. So you see, there are very important things. The acidity is very important for tannins, or phenolics, let's say phenolics. This is a better word than tannins.
But the tannins are more present in red wines than in white wines.
Yes, but phenolics are present everywhere. This is why I prefer the word phenolics. Tannins is an old word. It's like albumin. Albumin the chemists spoke of albumin 2 centuries ago, and now it's finished. They mentioned proteins, and there are certain proteins that coagulate, remember the egg white, and certain proteins that do not coagulate, remember the gelatin.
What about the glass. Much has been made about which glass should be used for wine. And there are even people like the Riedels who go around and will put the same glass, the same wine in five different glasses and ask you to...
It's so important, so important. You can make the experiment at home easily, you know. You have different glasses. Everybody has different glasses. You take the, use the triangular test. You know the triangular test?
No.
Oh, the idea would be you take three glasses. Two are the same, and the third is different. And you put the same quantity of wine in the three, and you just give them to the participant, and they have to recognize the two that are the same. This is triangular test. And you make it again and again on statistics. Otherwise, it's very easy if you know in advance to get the results. So this should be the rule when you make a test, always triangular.
And why does the glass affect the way wine tastes?
Oh.
It delivers the wine to different parts of our tongue?
Yeah.
But you just told me my tongue doesn't matter, that if the front of the tongue was recognized, it doesn't really recognize
sugar. No, not exactly the tongue. It's in wine, it's a paradox. Wine is a paradox because it's water. And in this water, you have the odorant. The bouquet is due to odorant molecules that are hydrophobic, that do not dissolve easily in water. How did God succeed in having a hydrophobic molecules into water? This is very strange. Well, this is another story, but anyway, these molecules want to go out of the wine. They go out, but depending on the shape of the glass, then they can go out differently. The temperature is very, very important because, of course, at any temperature, the kind of molecules that go out is different. So you feel better the fruit or better the taste and so on.
And very cold wine, you don't taste it as much. You don't get the full flavor.
You taste it differently because in your mouth you have the taste. And the taste is not the flavor, but the flavor is a general sensation. So.
But doesn't cold really just dull taste anyway? If you have an ice cream, for example, or a sorbet, if it's really frigid cold, you don't taste the flavor the same as you do as if it's just one, you know, it's fairly soft.
Yes, but it can be interesting. Imagine that in your sorbet you add some, for example, pepper, red pepper. You feel something different. So why not? Something very hot, for example, look at a chili from carne. Wow, it's interesting because the pungency is there, but the very hot temperature changes the and this, you could play with that. You could play, for example, we know perfectly that the peppers are active on certain part of the tongue that are responsible for pain and also for temperature. But what if, for example, you use mint plus pepper? You have the cold effect and the heat effect all together. Strange. The Lebanese cooking is using these kind of things.
My guest is Hervé Thys, T-H-I-S. His latest book, Molecular Gastronomy, Exploring the Science of Flavor, which is published by Columbia University Press. Well, let's talk a bit more about chilies. Some people are able to eat chilies whole, and I wonder if that's completely cultural because, let's say, children of Thailand grow up eating chilies and probably develop a certain tolerance to them.
Yeah, they probably develop a certain tolerance. This is not well known. We know that they can eat the chilies, that's true. So we know that there is some tolerance. But what does it mean from the, physiological apparatus point of view? This is not well known.
Would it require a dulling of the sensory fibers?
The science of flavor is very, very late. We all have ideas about what we feel because we all eat and we all feel things. But science is not feeling. It's not poetry. You have to measure things. And it's not so easy. For example, remember that the Nobel Prize was given to two American scientists some years ago about olfaction. But for taste... This is very late. And we are waiting the discovery of the same receptors in order to know better. For example, the receptor of sweetness is not known. We know things, but the territories to be discovering...
As basic as sweetness, wow. Yeah. When we eat hot, really hot food, sometimes our eyes tear. So there are all sorts of other things that are going on in the body as well.
Oh, there are many things. Generally, people think that the flavor is only taste plus odor. This is not true. There is a nerve called the trigeminal nerve that's coming from behind the brain. It has three branches, one in the nose, in the palate, and in the tongue. And this is the way you recognize pungency, freshness. Freshness has nothing to do with odor. You know, the mint is fresh, and the mint has the odor of mint. It's different. And recently in the States, someone has discovered one of the receptors of freshness. Imagine now that you can design a molecule that fits in the receptor, and then you can make coolers for your chewing gum, for example. Very, very fresh. Chefs have some feeling about that. For example, Daniel Boulou is using a lot of celery. Celery is fresh. Cucumber is fresh. Mint is fresh. But what else? For example, Pierre Gagnère had a wonderful dish. He's cooking some red pepper for hours, and finally, it's fresh. Well, it means that the freshness has nothing to do with the first molecules evaporating for a dish. It means that there are some molecules that we don't know, and we have to investigate to know how to give some fresh taste.
And that's opposite to what I would have thought. I would think the fresh taste comes from it being undercooked, not cooked for so long.
No. In some cases, but you know, even if you consider a French baguette, for example, the bread, when it is just out of the oven, it has been cooked for 30 minutes, 1 hour, and it can be fresh bread. This has nothing to do. Freshness is a strange idea.
What about cooking techniques? We're seeing all sorts of new things like trendy vacuum-packed, low-temperature cooking. I'm sure somebody out there has asked, what about microwave cooking? Are the results ever the same as they are with traditional methods?
No, you cannot compare. I would say, well, I would take it differently. When you want to get a result, there is probably a better tool than others. For example, let's consider mayonnaise. In mayonnaise, you use egg yolk, vinegar, and oil. Egg yolk is 52% water, vinegar is 90%, and oil is oil. How is it that you can mix the oil plus the water? The answer lies in the proteins that are in egg yolks. Okay. Generally, to make a mayonnaise, you just whip with a whisk. Okay, but the whisk was invented in the Middle Ages. Is it possible to do better? Yes, because you're cleaning your spectacles with ultrasonic devices. And at the lab, we have ultrasonic boxes to make emulsions. Mayonnaise is an emulsion. Oil into water. Oil disperses into water like droplets. Well, I have the feeling that in the kitchen we could have ultrasonic devices to make emulsions. On other systems. Recently, I introduced a pianoctel. The pianoctel is a machine, very funny, when you inject with pumps some products and you get dishes based on formulas. Well, it's very easy. You just press the button and get the emulsion.
Now, mayonnaise, you mentioned, is a mixture of fat and an acid. But now we're having low-fat vinegars. In fact, at the supermarket, we can buy products like fat-free heavy cream, which I've always wondered about. How can that be? I thought heavy cream, the whole idea was that it was fat. Can the laboratory help us satisfy our desire for fatty foods and other things that still might be unhealthy?
Well, when you have the knowledge, you can do exactly what you want. For example, if you know how the atom is done, with the protons, the neutrons, the electrons, and so on, you can decide to make the atomic bomb or just electricity. The same with food. You can decide to do exactly what you want. If you have to get low fat, you get low fat. If you have to get good taste, you have good taste. It's just a matter of decision, of knowledge and decision.
But you're taking flavor out. Just like a light beer takes carbohydrates out of the beer, it also takes some of the flavor out.
Wow.
Is there a way of putting the flavor back in?
Yeah. Depends on the way you do it. For example, you know, we all have the feeling that fat is bringing some flavor. Okay. But recently with Pierre Gagnère, I had a new idea. He was cooking a civet. Civet was cooking meat with red wine or game with wine. And I wanted to give to Pierre a new invention. So I decided to take the sauce and to filter it in a very good filter. And we had a glass of the sauce that was clear like a cognac. It was the civet taste, the pure civet taste in a glass of cognac. So Pierre Gagnère served the civet, the meat, and instead of the black heavy sauce, we had the clear liquid. Oh, it was wonderful.
So you, if you, the real trick is to experiment and then hope that it's going to come out interesting. This could take a lot of time for some chefs.
Well, but first of all, chefs could be trained to that. Then chefs could have allies. For example, technologists can work with chefs; they can help them. And in the future, you can envision a world when they will be trained since school and then become less, more and more skilled in chemistry and physics, and finally they can focus on the art and love.
So it will be different from the old days where somebody went to work as an apprentice in a kitchen and then eventually worked his way up. Now he's going to take a couple of chemistry and molecular gastronomy courses. The man who gave us molecular gastronomy is Hervé Thys, T-H-I-S. His latest book is of that name, Exploring the Science of Flavor. It's published by Columbia University Press, and I want to thank you so much for being such a wonderful guest.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.